Transmission start. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Join us as we wander off the path and explore lost history, consciousness, the paranormal, unexplained mysteries, alternative thought, and much more. We are present on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now here is your host, Soraya.
Greetings and welcome to this episode of Where Did the Road Go? Tonight I'm going to be talking with Thomas Spriggs, and Thomas has written a book called Into Nowhere, and it's an interesting book. It takes a look at the patterns of disappearances initially put down by David Politis. He's added some of his own observations into it. This is not a book of cases. He's not just putting out cases there. What he's doing is looking at the cases that exist, adding a few more in that he's found in his own research, and looking at the patterns that exist in these disappearances. As such, it's a little bit of a dry book. It's not meant so much as entertainment as information. If you're interested in this, I think he might actually have a piece here. It does make consistent sense. Perhaps after we had more cases, it might either verify or nullify it. But time will tell. And I did have an email related to this that I wanted to address. And this involves the paradoxical undressing. And David Politis has often cited this as not being possible in the cases that he is relaying. And this comes from Ryan. He says, I'm a board-certified neurologist in Idaho. I listened to your recent show with David Politis and Missing Hunters. Paradoxical undressing was discussed, and I wanted to give a physician's perspective. Paradoxical undressing is a real phenomena and has been reported in highly respected peer-reviewed medical journals. There is a clear pathology that explains why people do this. There are hundreds of cases where people who have died or survived severe hypothermia are found without clothes or missing clothes. Mr. Politis, when asked about this, referred to mountaineers who have climbed Everest not seeing this phenomena. He cites this evidence that paradoxical undressing is not real. There is a website that documents many of these climbers who have died on Everest, some of which are missing shoes, gloves, hats, etc., which shows this occurring on Everest. While paradoxical undressing doesn't explain why people are missing, it should be taken into account when clothes are missing or cold is involved. It should at least be something to consider as a real phenomena. There are 5 stages of hypothermia based on core temperature. Keep in mind the second stage, 28 to 32 degrees Celsius, that's 82 to 90 degrees Fahrenheit, people can have altered mental status. This may explain some of the reasons people act irrationally after exposure. Obviously, this doesn't explain the reason people are missing in all these cases, but it should be considered in some. While I think David has brought forth a fascinating phenomenon that I think is extremely worth looking at, when people are found in the wilderness after exposure to the elements, it is more logical to assume that paradoxical undressing than a supernatural etiology when exposed to cold is present. I'm afraid listeners and readers might be misled that the missing clothes is somehow supernatural or a key feature in missing people criteria when hypothermia is involved. I don't want the public thinking undressing when exposed to the cold is not real and could be explained scientifically in some of the cases he describes. I will put the website that he refers to in the show notes on the website at wheredidtheroadgo.com if anyone wants to check it out. And as he says, it doesn't explain all the cases. There are cases where the clothing is found neatly folded and put to the side, which I don't think is going to be something you're going to find in paradoxical undressing. There's also cases where this is happening in warmer temperatures where they're not wouldn't have been experiencing hypothermia, but it has definitely something that has to be considered in some of these cases. With that being said, I also want to throw out a thank you to Allison, who gave us a generous donation this week. If you want to help us out with the show, you can donate to us right on the website at wheredidtheroadgo.com. You can also become a patron and get extra content for only $3 a month. We have a forum on the website. If you want to discuss any of the topics we have here, please go join the forum and talk to us. We have a Facebook group for the same reason. And one last note about tonight's interview. When I was recording it, for some reason, we kept getting some weird static. We would talk for a while crystal clear, and then he would sort of get a reverb static thing going on, and I'd have to cancel the call and call him back. So for a minute or two here and there throughout the interview, you'll hear this static kind of build up. I tried to filter it out a little. There's only so much I could do. And then it'll just go away because we we redid the call and everything was fine for a little bit. So I apologize for that. It might be a little irritating here and there, but it doesn't last for very long. And on that, this is my interview with Thomas Spriggs about his book, Into Nowhere. And I am talking to Mr. Thomas Spriggs. And your book, and now I'm assuming this is your first book. I know it's your first book on this subject. It's called Into Nowhere.
Yes, sir. It is my first book on this subject. It's one of those things that I just happened to stumble on an idea about and then just followed through with it. And by the time I had fleshed it out, I realized I was just going to have to make a book out of it and put it out for everybody to be able to have access to.
Okay. So tell people a little bit about your background real briefly.
Okay. I work for the University of Phoenix in technical support. I have my bachelor's degree in journalism from Arizona State University. I have my master's from Grand Canyon University, but I owe them for a class because I had a statistics class that just killed me. So I owe them for a class still, or I'll have my master's. And I live in Arizona. I've lived here since 2001, so it's been about 15 years now. And I just happen to be close enough to where David Politis is at that we get some news out of Colorado, out of that area, right? Because it's so much attached up in northern Arizona into the Colorado Plateau and everything. And I originally run into it when it came to the DNA, the Bigfoot DNA.
Right, right.
Which was something I was interested in anyway. Mm-hmm. But the rest of my background was I grew up in southern Ohio, a little town called Portsmouth. It's right on the border with Kentucky, foothills of the Appalachians. There's a 63,000-acre state park right there, Shawnee State University State Park. And I grew up hunting, fishing, loved to fish, running around in that, playing in the creeks, and was a country boy. So I'm used to being out in the woods. I'm used to flora and fauna. But what got me into making this book was when I was listening to the Bigfoot DNA, then I started following Mr. Politis because obviously he's an excellent speaker when it comes to interviews and doing things live. And then I discovered the Missing 411 books. And like everybody else, I was just fascinated. I was blown away. I lived near the state forest, and I'd never heard of anybody disappearing and, you know, some big search for them. But then it's one of those areas that if you look at the map and you look at where these things are at, it's not a big place for them. We had one in 1944, the year before my mom was born, which was his own little story, which he told in Missing 411. But
really?
Yeah. I can't remember the name of the person, but I remember they were a little boy and they found him up in the hills. Some teenagers did, just way far away from where they were searching, standing in the middle of a trail. Just standing in the middle of a trail.
Right. Yeah.
So, but I got reading them, and after a while, the little bells started going off in my head. Because I know he talks about them being in clusters and in little small areas, and there'll be one there and there won't be another one there for like another 10 years. Mm-hmm. But he started talking about Pennsylvania as being like an ongoing series of these things. And then about the fourth book, there's areas in there where he talks about the pairs of them that happened close together in time. And he just happened to talk about two boys that disappeared in New York. They were, they disappeared from around, I remember it's called Neversink Reservoir. And one of the boys disappeared from one side of it near the reservoir and they never found him. And the other boy disappeared from the other side of it. And then when they did find his body, they found him in the creek that ran into Neversink Reservoir. Hmm. So that really set the bells off in my head of, that's not random. That's some entity that knows how to get around in this area and move through it and not be seen. And at the same time, had a, you know, this tendency to make this happen. The one that disappeared, and I've got the names here, Fred Tukey Holmes is the one that disappeared just 1 mile from the Neversink Reservoir. And then David Raleigh, I believe, was the one who was found in the creek for the reservoir the next 4 years later. So I started going through, and I made a big spreadsheet of all the different places that these disappearances, you know, had out of the books. And then I sorted them. I sorted them by state, but I put them side by side so I could see whether the dates in one state, like Pennsylvania, and the dates in another state, like Ohio or West Virginia, something that's next to Pennsylvania, if they overlapped.
Right.
To see if there was more to it than that. And then I started plotting them out. And sure enough, what I found through the data and through plotting them out was that 66.4% of all these cases are actually linked as regions. The clusters aren't really just clusters. A lot of times they're hubs. They're where the disappearances might happen once, and then a couple years later it'll happen a couple of counties away, and then a couple of counties away, and then a couple of counties in a different direction, and then back there again.
Hmm.
And we can talk about specifics of that, because if you look through the book, there's places where I point out to you where you can just literally see movement back and forth. Not only that, but I discovered by plotting them out that a lot of these regions change. They'll absolutely change. Like in the Northeast, early on when they had the breakouts from about 1928 to I've got the book open. I've got the maps here, so just trying to find the right one that will give us the details that I want to cover with that. There we go. So the group in the Northeast that happens early on is from 1922 to 1958. And if you look at it, it's that section where he talks about in the Missing 411 books about the Bennington Triangle. In that little corner of basically western Connecticut,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and Vermont, down in that little section there, it spills over actually into that very western part. That's the bulk of it. But it runs, most of them run along this little strip just right up the coast from there and into Maine with a little side group to the south of it. And it's interesting because most of these have a main body of disappearances where most of them occur, but they have little groups of outliers off to the side that happens every so often. It's almost as if intentionally, there's been too many disappearances here and there's too many people in the woods looking for other people. Maybe I need to distract somebody. It's almost like it's intentional, like it's an intelligent thought, because it happens in so many different places.
Mm-hmm.
And it happens here along the coast, down in lower Massachusetts and into Connecticut, back towards New York. So you have this area where it just moves back and forth in here, whatever is doing this, and just making people disappear every so often.
And then it just kind of stops.
And the weird thing is, sometimes when it stops, it stops totally. At the end of this, there had hardly been in this period of time from 22 to 58, there had hardly been any in New York, and only actually one up in the area of the Adirondacks. But in 1958, there's, I think, one in Connecticut, and all the rest of them from 58 to 62 take place in that part of northern New York. And then they stop for like 6 years. Well, when they start up again, there are literally no disappearances in that Bennington Triangle area. All the disappearances, the bulk of them, have moved into the Adirondacks. And that's now the center of this. It just moved. Just moved to the north and to the west. And then this small area of outliers that are down in the southeast, it almost evaporates. There's only three of those. And I just find these patterns over and over again. If you can tell that there's something here, and then it moves to another location. And it has these patterns having a lot of times precursors. It's like there's one or two or three, maybe four in a big area, right? Mm-hmm. Almost as if it's testing the water to say, what happens if someone disappears? How hard did they come at? You know, what's going to be the response, right? You know, are they going to saddle up the horses and, you know, and ride out and just cover everything, or what's the response? And then once it becomes a matter of, yeah, there's not that big of a response, which is another subject we can talk about, then it seems to just take off. And they'll take off, they'll stop, they'll move, they'll start over. It's fascinating to see, once I plotted them out on the maps, how these areas do this and change so consistently. Probably the one that fascinates me the most is the one in the southeast, down near the Great Smoky Mountains National Park, basically because it's a big area. It goes from the border of Virginia and North Carolina over near the Tidewater all the way back over in this little arch towards Birmingham. And their outliers are just this little area between Charleston and Columbia. But it doesn't really work that way. Basically, here you can literally almost just trace what's going on. The first one takes place actually in the area around Birmingham in 1951. And then there's another one at the other end of the southern part of this up near the Great Smoky Mountain National Park. And then the next ones are the ones that take place down near the Birmingham area. The other four, there's four of them that take place down in this little cluster. Then they move back again, back up to the Great Smoky Mountain National Park. So you would say, well, that doesn't sound very connected. Mm-hmm. But here's the thing. In that little burst of activity there from 51 to 62 part of that grouping, the last three take place exactly in between the other two parts of the set. They take place in 1961 at Lookout Mountain. And in Jasper, Tennessee in 1958, and Falls Branch, Tennessee in 1962. As if to say, here I am right in the middle of all this. But what happens next is just absolutely, I couldn't have written this if I'd wanted to into like a horror book or something. In 1963, a little girl named Phyllis Powell disappears from Woodland, North Carolina, the farthest over towards the tidewater that this goes, just south of the border of Virginia, near Murfreesboro. Mm-hmm. Okay, she was 5 years old. She lived on this street, and I believe I've heard Mr. Plytus talk about it before, but I don't think it was any of his books. He was just talking about it as things that he had found as well, because I know he seems to have done that a couple of times. Mm-hmm. But they're like, you could throw a baseball the whole length of this. Everybody lives there. We're friends or close family. And she disappeared. They do this massive search. The only thing they find are two footprints near the forested area about a mile from her home. Okay? So 2 years later, at Pilot Mountain, Bonnie Lee Edward disappears. This is halfway back towards the Great Smoky Mountain National Park, along the border with Virginia and North Carolina at Pilot Mountain, okay? It's just northwest of the Winston-Salem area. And then 4 years later, in 1969, a little boy disappears back in the Great Smoky Mountain National Park, and his name is Dennis Lloyd Martin. Mm, now, yes. I couldn't have made that up if I had wanted to, okay?
Oh, man.
I mean, just step and step along.
Yeah.
And that's not the only place that happens. In Arkansas and Oklahoma, which is just another one of those areas, they're precursors. The ones that happen that are kind of scattered out, And I want to explain, I set some rules for this when I started looking at this. I kind of said, okay, so they have to be at least every couple of years on average, right? So there's got to be at least 12 and 25 years, 5 and 12 years, something like that. So they're close enough together that they're just not scattershot.
Right.
They have to go on for at least 10 years, it seems to me. I mean, even if it's shorter than that, then it's just something passing through. Right, and it may not mean anything a whole lot for that territory. And if there's a 5-year gap between disappearances, I generally say that the agent causing this is stopped or moved or, you know, died or whatever the case may be. And whatever happens after that is a restart if it happens in that area. The precursor ones, there's 9 of them over 31 years. In the Arkansas, Oklahoma area. The first two are in this little area called Waldron. It's just on the Arkansas side of the border. Probably just a little south of the center of it. Mm-hmm. And there's two there. One was Pearl Turner, and then the other one was Maritha Yarborough, who disappeared 7 years later. Interestingly enough, though, from there, the next disappearance is to the southeast, a fair distance. A gentleman named Charles Waldron disappeared in 1935 from Hot Springs. 2 years after that, Florence Jackson disappeared from Oak Grove. It's up near the Missouri border, but it's south of all the lakes that are along the border between those two states.
Mm-hmm.
The next one disappears to the west in Cloudy, Oklahoma. A girl named Jackie Landreth went missing. Interestingly enough, out of this group that I'm talking about, 5 of the 7 victims are females, unlike most places where Mr. Plytus has clearly mentioned it. There's way more males than females that disappear.
Mm-hmm.
Not in this little group for some reason. But the next one is Lloyd Hokett, who disappears in the Kiamichi Mountains on the Oklahoma side of the border, just to the southwest of Waldron. And then the next year, Catherine Van Alst disappears in Devil's Den State Park, which is almost directly north of Waldron in Arkansas. So what you have is you have these two disappearances that start in the middle and in this long, big march to the southeast, up to the north, counterclockwise, most of the way around. The original disappearances take place around that. And then the last one of the precursors here takes place just north of where the original ones are. I mean, How does that happen randomly? You know,
yeah.
Statistically, what's the chances of these things happen where you could get in your car and just drive from town to town and just drive a big circle around Waldron?
I guess the only thing I can see that could be a monkey wrench in that is if these cases are not actually the same thing happening.
That's true, and that I don't really talk to directly. I do go a little bit further than Mr. Politis. I use the term predator in a couple places,
mm-hmm.
not because I necessarily want to bend people's thoughts towards any particular outcome for this, right?
Mm-hmm.
But because it seems to me that we're dealing with something that works along the lines of either there's something just overpowering, naturally overpowering, that's grabbing these people, right? Or it's a lot like watching mosquitoes fly into a bug zapper. They're just out there having fun, enjoying their day, and poof, zap, gone, right?
Yeah.
I can't tell you which. I mean, some of these stories are just crazy. I mentioned that I actually wrote this about a gentleman that disappeared in Virginia, right?
Okay.
And it's fascinating because he was actually out at the one of the battlefields at Shenandoah Mountain. He's at the breastworks, Confederate breastworks. Okay, his name was Robert Fitzgerald, and he was on the breastworks trail on Shenandoah Mountain, out having fun in the afternoon. Leaves, because I believe that's one of those parks that, you know, you can't stay in. It kind of closes because it's, you know, it's also like a national monument kind of thing, right?
Right.
But he drops his cell phone, okay? And he doesn't realize it until he gets home. Well, once he's home, he tells people, hey, yeah, I got to go back in the morning and get my cell phone. So in the morning, on November 12th, 2012, Mr. Fitzgerald, he drives back, parks in the parking lot, gets out, probably locks his car, walks up the trail, okay? Park rangers that afternoon realize this guy's not coming back to his car. So they just gather whoever people they have there, and they start a search, right? They start up the trail that he started up. 1 mile up the trail, they found his phone laying on the edge of the trail.
Right, somewhere he would have seen it.
Yeah. So he didn't make it a mile because he didn't pick his cell phone up.
Hmm. But On the one hand, I look at it and I'm looking at the patterns you're making. I'm wondering if it's some kind of natural phenomena that people are disappearing into. You know, I mean, I don't know what that would be. It would be saying we don't understand yet. Maybe a slip in dimensions or something like that, where people are in the wrong place at the wrong time. At the same time, there seem to be patterns to the type of people who are disappearing, which suggests it's more planned, or maybe it's a little bit of both.
Right. Right. And one thing that strikes me about it, now that I plotted these all out and I understand more about where and when, I want to let you know that part of what took me so long, I worked on this book for 10 and a half months, is that I didn't just go by what Mr. Politis had in his book. I wanted to have as much data as I could. So I went out and I did this internet search that took me forever and ever and ever. I used the Namus database. I used charlie.org. I went on and just looked, and I ended up adding about 234 people to this. And when I boiled it all down, I ended up with 898 cases. And I think if you look at his books, you put them all together, just cases. You know, if two people disappear at one time, that's still just one case.
Right.
Because I'm more interested in plotting out where and when. Mm-hmm. than the individual parts of it, in a way. The 898 took a long time to get out there and get to where I had it plotted out. But with the consistency I get out of it, it's hard to say that it's not in some way done by a certain level of intelligence.
Right.
I mean, there's no way that, you know, this could not be done by someone of intelligence. But also, I've noticed that we're talking about something that's not really shy about going right up to the doorstep of a major city and making someone disappear. Right?
Yeah. And at the same time, these aren't just happening everywhere. They, as you're showing, and as David initially showed, they happen in these groups, and you're showing mm-hmm. how they happen in very specific ways in these groupings.
Right.
And like you point out, there's very few cases in Texas for some reason.
Yeah, and you would think, you know, Texas is big, it's open. The whole northeast part of Texas, right, has standing pine forests. It's not all that different from Louisiana or Georgia or places where these do occur. And there's hardly anything in the northeast section of Texas there where there's plenty of cover and food. Mm-hmm. So it's just random enough that if you don't take some time to try to, you know, for us to start wrapping our heads around it, you can miss it. But almost as soon as you start digging into the data, you start going, oh my goodness, right? This is something else. In the southeast, that little group of disappearances that took place down in the what I tell you, where it just kind of worked its way back to the Great Smoky Mountain National Park. The first one of those outliers took place Shortly after Dennis Lord Mike disappeared, there was another boy that disappeared just right up the Appalachian Trail from where he did. But then there was another boy that disappeared there, and he was next. His dad was in the military base at Fort, I believe it was Fort Jackson. And give me just a second, and I'll have that up here, because I actually have a list where I can look at some of the cases where I added to it, and some of them are, it's at Fort Jackson. His name is Michael Woodward. His father was like the master sergeant on that fort. He was playing in his yard when his father disappeared, when his child disappeared, and his father was actually mowing grass in the yard with him. Now, that's bold to walk up to someone's house and make a kid disappear, right?
Yeah.
And this was someone who was well-liked and important at the base. They threw 400 soldiers out into the field. They had 3 helicopters. They had people in jeeps. They had people on horseback and motorcycles. They never found a sign of this boy. I mean, and it's not the only place you've seen where kids have disappeared right on the edge of a military base. That's bold.
True.
And that's something that knows human nature enough to know how to get around and into the edges of a city.
Or disguise itself.
Or disguise itself. That's true. That's true. And Mr. Politis has talked about that a little bit. And like I said, I'm not saying I have any answers. I have like 4 answers and 10,000 questions now, right? Because I've just opened this can of worms, and I'm still trying to digest it and fully understand even what I've done with it.
Yeah.
Now talk
a little bit about the straight line outliers.
Okay, so you get these, and it happens in a couple of different places. It happens off the Pennsylvania, off the main group of disappearances back in the 30s and 40s and 50s. And it also happens south of where the disappearances happen, up along the western end of the Great Lakes. And these are really odd, because these are the ones, one of the ones that happened in my hometown. These straight line outliers are more of where they happen in an area, but it's not a grouping where they're happening obviously in just this little tiny space. They're happening almost a given distance from the main area of the disappearances. Like I said, that it seems to be intentional of drawing attention away, lowering the pressure and the number of searchers there are out, and people are out in the woods in the main area where disappearances happen. But instead of being in an area, basically what's happening is this agent is going so far from the main group and making someone disappear there. And when that's matured and there's enough disappearances in an area, these disappearances are basically in almost a straight line. You can just go out and you could spray paint a line down across these counties, and the disappearances are like within 20 miles each side of it or so. Just right along this area. Just like, okay, well, we're going to go 70 miles away from here and get away from all the pressure that we're creating by disappearances in this area. And we're going to have people go down here, and we're going to go the same distance and the same distance and the same distance again. And I'm not sure I really understand why that would be. Because there's places like in South Carolina where it would be easier to go a certain distance because it's fairly flat.
Mm-hmm.
The ones in Wisconsin, in the south of the west end of the Great Lakes, those are straight line, and it makes sense because it's flat. But like I said, Portsmouth, Ohio is in the foothills of the Appalachians. It's kind of hard to go exactly 70, 80 miles and, you know, through that kind of – but that's what happened along that southwestern edge of the main disappearances from Pennsylvania.
It's almost like the terrain doesn't matter.
Yeah, the terrain doesn't matter here, except for I would say this. If you look at the maps, and I probably didn't cover this as much in the book as what I should have, the vast majority of these areas, not all of them, but the bigger, really bigger areas, they do seem to carry and follow mountain ranges. They like fall off the sides of the mountain ranges down into the lower areas.
What about water proximity? Do you find that it's often based around where water is?
Yeah, I do. And that's also one where it's kind of odd, because that's really the case in Texas. Texas has this one big kind of loose area that covers like the central part of the state down to Houston. But there's only 27 disappearances in the whole state of Texas, which is crazy, right? Because it's huge. But if you read the descriptions of those, it's like reservoir, reservoir, lake, reservoir, river. They're like all attached to water. Almost literally all attached to water. But there's just odd things about how some of these patterns appear too, as far as there's also sometimes disappearances between groupings. After the little thing in the center of the Arkansas and Oklahoma area, there's only four disappearances for a very long time. Those four disappearances are the furthest out that happen in that whole region. The one that's furthest east, the one that's furthest north, the one that's furthest west, southwest, at Lake Texoma, just north of the border with Texas. And then here's another phenomenon I find as well. After those four little outliers that just basically literally just outline where these disappearances occur, a lot of times when these disappearances happen, the disappearances will start at the extreme of a range and work their way back. If you look at the maps for Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, I put three maps in all together, because if you look at the ones that happened between the real early loose set that took place in the 1880s, there's just some scattered ones that are up in northern Ohio along Lake Erie. There's some down around not Pittsburgh, but Philadelphia, which is one of those places where it just was right up to the doorstep of the city in a couple events.
Right.
And then they start happening a little more often in those two areas, okay? Where they're starting to happen close together now. They're like a couple years apart, just one here and there. But they're in those same two areas. But then, after there's a few of them at each end of this, there almost appears to be to where whatever's happening at the edges of this come together. I'm looking up the map right now so I can give you the exact dates. From about 1938 to 1944, those blue dots stop being at the two ends of this extreme, and they start happening in the middle. And by the time that's done in 1960, the bulk of all these disappearances is actually along the southern two-thirds of Pennsylvania into northern West Virginia, Virginia, over to central Ohio, and over east towards Philadelphia. So, but it starts on the ends, and then it moves to the middle.
Right.
And I don't know why, but that happens more than once, too. That happens in Arkansas. So, after that little circle around Waldron in Arkansas, when the main group of disappearances start, the first one I actually just consider an outlier, because it happens just outside Oklahoma City. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And then the next one... let me see. I want to get to where I give you some names. From there, it actually just moves east. The next one's in Bausch, Oklahoma, just south of Lake Eufaula, which, yeah, if anybody is in that area, they know where I'm talking about. It's most of the way over to the border of Arkansas. In 2001, Gloria McDonald disappears from Queen Wilhelmina State Park. I believe Mr. Polite has covered that. And then just 3 days later, back just on the other side of the border, Jeffrey Benn disappears from Tuskahoma Bridge in Oklahoma, near Tuskahoma. He was in a minor accident south of the bridge, and he wasn't out far away from things. People were close enough, they actually heard the accident. So it took probably a few minutes, right, for people to get there. By the time they did, he was gone. They did this huge search, never found anything. In 2006, 5 years later, his body was found 2 miles from where that accident occurred. And then it just moves right over into Arkansas, and the rest of the disappearances in that region take place. Just, and then, you know, I would say that if I'd only found one or two spots where this happened and they didn't overlap like that, probably not a whole lot to it.
Right.
But there's something odd going on here when I can point to, okay, so this moved along this trail or this moved in this direction, and I can do it in multiple cases like that. That's indicates to me that, like I said, this agent is picking areas that it goes into and it knows really well, and it knows this way around. It knows how to get in, you know, to stand basically over to over a ridge overlooking San Jose or something, and go and get down into the edges of the city, and not even the end of like the first cul-de-sac. I mean, you know, a couple few blocks in or streets in or whatever, and make someone disappear and get back out. And there's just that sense of intelligence and purposefulness, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it also could be something moving from outside of our perception or even outside of our dimension of existence and just popping in and popping out. And maybe these areas are where it can actually do that at certain times.
Right. It knows, okay, so there's only so many people here, you know, this is a small town, you know, everybody goes to bed at 10, everything's closed, you know, I can wander around the edge of this freely, right?
Mm-hmm.
And get in and out and not be seen. I'm technologically advanced enough to do that, or, you know, have whatever skills it takes to get in and out of there, because it just, these patterns happen and so often that you just can't ignore the sense that this is intentional. And I would say, at least to some extent, malicious. You know, I mean, it's most of these people aren't coming back.
Right. Right.
We're not finding most of them later. So it's doing something with them that it doesn't want us to know about. I mean, clearly.
I would assume so, yes.
You know, although
when they do come back and they're found, there's usually no cause of death. It's not like something violent is necessarily happening to them. So I also got to wonder if maybe they're going through something, they're just not surviving.
Yeah, and that may be. And, you know, that's the thing probably that one of the things that disturbed me the most, that and the children being found, you know, in just crazy places.
Mm-hmm.
Up on mountaintops. I mean, because I'm in Arizona. The one boy that disappeared on Mount Baldy, and I can't remember his name off the top of my head, and I apologize for that.
That's all right.
I've actually camped out at Lake Holly, which is about 20 miles to the other side of that from where he disappeared. And that's incredibly rough. A terrain. It's not flat at all. It's a quite a drive to get into, but it's dense brush. It's heavy tree lines, and it's not all pine trees. They have aspen and a lot of maple up there. So you have, you know, trees that get brush thrown in around the edge of them. There's a lot of small streams. It is, you know, this perfect territory, but it doesn't. But these things don't always happen there. That little boy's been the only person to disappear from that part of Arizona.
Hmm.
So, you know, on the one hand, I can say, yeah, it follows mountain ranges. But on the other hand, there's plenty of mountain ranges out there. Nothing.
Right, right. One of the things you talk about a little bit is some observations about where the Native Americans in that area made their settlements and stuff.
Oh yeah, yeah. I when I got my degree at Arizona State University, Being a bit of a history buff anyway, I took a bunch of classes on history. I took ancient Greek and modern Japanese and Chinese, and I just happened to take a class about the Native Americans in the desert Southwest. So I kind of had an idea of where a lot of these were. And so I made it my hobby for a few years when I had the opportunity and the time to go visit a lot of these places. And I was really struck by the fact that there's very few of the big settlements for these Native Americans that are actually built up on the Mongolian Rim and in the White Mountains inside the forests. There's a couple. There's the one at Maple Canyon. That's kind of inside more than the edge of the forest. There's a small one at the top of the Grand Canyon, which if you've ever been to the main visitor center, you've seen it because it's just right there off the road. Mm-hmm. But all the rest of them are built a certain distance away from the forest itself, even though we know they hunted in the forest because they left behind the stone drawings, the petroglyphs where you know they show us deer and rabbit and birds, right, and lizards. And so we know that they hunted these animals or they wouldn't have made these petroglyphs of them.
Sure.
And yet they didn't build their sites, their homes, actually inside the edge of the forest. Waputki, the one that I put a picture in, or Wupatki that I put the picture in, mm-hmm. Into the book, that is actually in the scrubland north of Flagstaff as you start heading up towards Page and the border with Utah. But yeah, I mean, there's tons of trees, lakes, rivers south of there, and yet they build their home up here. There's a lake out here called Lake Roosevelt over to the east of Phoenix, and it's one of our main water supplies. Well, there's also some Indian pueblos up there, but they are up almost near the top of these very large hills that surround Lake Roosevelt, high up and into the sides of the cliffs, and it's got to be a good mile back down to the lake. Well, when they were there, it was a river. Nobody had dammed it up, so it would have been at least a mile for them to get from where they lived to the nearest water and to a place where they could, you know, do a little agriculture and grow some corn and, you know, some beans eventually when those came into the area. Mm-hmm. Why would you build so far away from where you have to work every day to grow your food? You know?
Yeah.
And this is something you see over and over again. The White House in Canyon du Chelly, built into the side of a cliff. The King's Castle is on the way to Sedona, built into the side of a cliff. The Navajo National Monument. They hiked the Keats Seal, built into the side of a cliff. Well, why? I mean, you know, there were some symbols and some evidence that it wasn't always peaceful between the different tribes. But it doesn't look like, for the most part, that any of them were really burnt out. So it makes sense to be defensive. But why this pattern all the time, you know?
Yeah.
You would think that there would be, yeah, some people are going to live over here and they're going to do more growing corn, and other people are going to live closer to the forest and closer in, and they're going to do hunt and they're going to trade corn for meat, and right? And it's the same pattern all over the state, which is fascinating. But it's one of those things, again, I had to observe it for a while and then I realized, I'm not really driving into the forest around Flagstaff to look at Indian ruins, because there aren't any there. The other thing I talked about just a little bit, and it's another thing I didn't really know anything about until I saw a TV show, right? I watched that Killer Yeti thing that they had on.
Oh, yeah.
About the
Dyatlov Pass?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was wondering why you connected that in there. I mean, I can sort of see it. But it seems like there might be a more prosaic explanation. It's really hard to tell what happened there at all.
Yeah, and basically I threw it in just to say, okay, so We need to take a look at this too. I mean, I don't think it's necessarily the same thing, but it could be clue. It could give us some clues if we try to understand it a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, I did it mostly because of the maps the pictures I found of them digging out the snow and then when they found the tent, right? When they went to search for the people,
right?
Because there's all these theories about there was this horrible snowstorm. And there was, some sort of avalanche or something like that. And I basically threw it in because I just wanted to kind of put it out there that, we may not really have the answer on why they abandoned that attempt the way they did. Because there's two skis in there. There's a ski in there that they stuck into the ground, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it just so happens that when I looked at both of the pictures, that's the same ski standing up in the second picture as in the first picture where they were digging in the snow. Okay? So I flipped the picture of them digging in the snow around, and I overlaid it on top of the one where they found the tent. And voila, they match up perfectly. It almost literally looks like the soldier or the rescuer that's in the picture that the Soviet government took is standing over them watching them dig out of the snow, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I can tell a few things from that just by putting the two pictures together. I can tell, first of all, there was there's no avalanche before what you're seeing in the picture that the Dyatlov party took, because they're standing basically where the tent's going to be put.
Right.
And if there would have been some sort of snow slide, you wouldn't stand on top of people while you're digging them out. I mean, that doesn't make any sense.
Sure.
All the equipment is still outside. But at the same time, their picture is clear enough as far as the people standing there that you can see that there's not a lot of snow blowing around. And there's not a lot of making their jackets flap in the breeze or anything, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can see that the jackets aren't pressed against their body and, being pushed off in the direction the wind's going. So my question then becomes, if you look at the two pictures together and the snow level's almost exactly the same, it's clearly there's no avalanche after,
right?
But there's also no snowstorm, because where's the snow? you can't have a snowstorm without snow. And I just wanted to toss that out there because
yeah.
I think that's one of those things that needs to have a little more study done into it. I know people do that one But I'm just trying to nudge people. My book is really, and I say it over and over again, it's just to push other people to get into this, right?
Yeah, and
because
look for.
I don't have all the answers.
Yeah, looking for. I mean, this is a good step in looking for patterns. It definitely is. The way you outlay this, it's very interesting. It doesn't necessarily tell us what's going on, but it suggests things that things aren't so random.
Exactly. And so here's the thing. If it's not random, then it's something else. And people who have experience and who do the study and do the research and understand other phenomena that's going on need to step up and take this places where I can't, because I don't have that experience, where Mr. Politis does it because he doesn't have the time and probably doesn't have some of the experience. The answer is going to come from other people, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And so all I wanted to do was help build another layer of this to where we now kind of have a floor. We understand kind of what happens, and we kind of understand how it happens to what extent we can. And now we kind of understand where and that they are actually attached to each other in time and area.
Mm-hmm.
So now go and tell me, go and tell me, are these areas that have lots of UFOs, is this an area of a lot of Sasquatch sightings, or is there other things that other phenomenon that might be attached to this? But with this floor now, people in these areas don't have an excuse for not going and trying to find connections between their research and these other phenomenon. It needs to be attached to other phenomenon so that we do finally start to put a picture together of why people go out in the woods and disappear when they're just walking up a trail to get their cell phone and it's not even a mile away or so.
Yeah, yeah. There was a case you talked in here, the Branson Miller case. You remember that one?
Yeah, give me just a second. I will find that because I believe that's Branson Miller. Let me see if I can find him.
I had made a note, so I'm assuming there was something about it that interested me.
Yeah. Yep. So give me just a second. Let me look in my main spreadsheet. And I also want to mention, the reason I didn't put the spreadsheet in is because they do charge so much at Amazon to print, right? Mm,
right, right.
That I just didn't want to add like 10 pages and jack up the price even more for the print version because that's just crazy.
Yeah, and your print version does have full-color maps and stuff, which is why the price is up a little bit.
Right, exactly. They just charge so much to print. So Branson Miller, let me find him. Now this one, okay. So, you know, there were some surprises that I found when I went and I added my cases in to what Mr. Politis had.
Uh-huh.
And this is in one of those areas. For example, if you just went by what Mr. Politis had in his books, Philadelphia is or Pennsylvania, Ohio is this huge, huge set of disappearances, right? But when I added mine in, it turns out that the Northeast actually has so many more that I found that I added that New York actually has more disappearances in New York than there are in Pennsylvania now.
Hmm.
Branson Miller was also one of those because he happened in Missouri. And there's another pattern that we haven't really talked about yet. And that pattern is one that takes place after the earlier disappearances I was talking about in the Southeast. Sometimes these disappearances, instead of becoming a main group and then a little side group, a little set of outliers, they become parallel tracks. Like there's two long stretches of territory that are separated, but the disappearances happen at the same time, and they're literally parallel to each other.
Right.
And that's part of this. I found several in Missouri that are new that actually ended up making two sets of parallel tracks. One was along the western edge along the Missouri River, and then the other one was along the eastern edge down the Mississippi River. You talk about connected to water. You can't get much more connected to water than that.
Yeah.
But Branson Miller was as actually one of those cases. He was working on a car with some friends. Went to a shed in his backyard to put away some jumper cables where they were trying to jump the car, and he never came back. Interestingly enough, they said that when they went and looked in the shed, they did not find the jumper cables, but that the jumper cable showed up a couple of weeks later. Now, that may not seem like much of a coincidence, but here's the thing. If you go online, there is a picture of that shed where you can see it. It's in this small town that's built on this very flat area, it looks like. And there's two houses beyond the shed that you can see the edges of in the picture. And then there's a gravel road and probably about a football field or so, open field, and then a tree line in the back. Okay?
Right.
How does he walk to this shed and disappear in any manner with so much open territory and two houses there?
Yeah.
How does no one see anything? I mean, you talk about sounding like someone just walking into a bug zapper. But the picture of it made that one just... we're not talking like a big barn kind of shed. We're talking about one of those little things that you buy at the Home Depot or something. You know, it's like
right,
four
right.
by four.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a tiny little thing. You could hardly hide behind it if you wanted to, you know.
And
you certainly aren't going to make a break for the trees and not be seen.
And where were the jumper cables found back in the shed?
Yeah, the jumper cables were literally found inside the shed.
But they weren't there when he first went missing.
No, they weren't there. But no, they didn't show up for 2 weeks.
That makes it even more bizarre.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it does.
Was he ever found?
He was never found, I don't believe.
Huh.
Not that I saw. And then there's another fascinating thing like that. And I think this is one of those things. Well, let me add this. I think that there are two patterns that we need to add to these patterns of how these disappearances occur. And one of them is like that, of people who disappear near their home on the outside or disappear from around a permanent cabin that's there every year and people use it all summer. Because you'd think that predators wouldn't go around those kinds of structures nearly as often, right? I mean, yeah, I've seen a couple of pictures on the internet of a mountain lion sitting on someone's porch. But that doesn't happen very often. Most predators don't know that. But just, you know, this is the second time we've talked about someone disappearing just outside their house. You know, the little boy disappeared outside of Fort Jackson. His dad was mowing the grass, and he was playing in the yard outside his house. And there's enough of those, I think they add up to something. And there's enough of people who disappear from around their cars. As the gentleman I mentioned that disappeared in Oklahoma, that I think that that's also another pattern.
Could be, yes.
You know, because there have been just odd things as far as that goes. So I want to talk to you about Robert Vernier. He got into an auto accident, and after the accident, I think he went to try to get help from what I understand. He walked into the woods, and they tracked him for quite a ways, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And they track him down along a river, and then they track him up onto the side of a ridge. And all of a sudden, the dog sat down, footprints in, and he's just gone. He's gone, just a bug zapper. I mean, I don't know how else to describe it. I mean,
yeah.
You know, how do you do that? And I can't remember off the top of my head. I wish I could remember the person's name. Mr. Politis put a person in his book of this lady that had been going to a Catholic retreat, like a monastery or something, right? Mm-hmm. And she abandons her car, runs out of gas. But her response to that was really weird, because you'd think if you need to go get gas, you're going to walk along the road, right, and walk up. She knew where she was at, basically. Walk along the road, come out to a main road. This was in some, you know, some dirt road in between two-lane paved roads that were probably used pretty regularly.
Right.
But she doesn't do that. If I remember right, they tracked her trail down along a creek that's clearly not going to leave you out in the open where people are going to easily see you. And then all of a sudden she walks up on a hill, and when they went to look for her, the dog sat down, the footprints in, and she's gone, just like this gentleman I just spoke of. Now, I don't know what this means.
Right, right.
But it's creepy that it's so the same. Why wasn't she walking along the road? Why wasn't he walking along the road? If you're out of gas, you had an accident, you're trying to flag someone down, why would you walk out in the middle of the woods? I mean, were they trying to avoid something? Like I said, I have 4 answers and 10,000 questions.
Or were they disoriented?
Possibly. That's quite possible. And then, like I said, the ending of it being so same, right? They just walk up on a ridge, they walk up on a little hillside, and poof, they're gone from there. And that's not exactly explainable.
All right. Well, the book is called Into Nowhere.
Yep.
And people can get it on Amazon. You have both the Kindle version and a print version.
Correct. And just go to Amazon.com, type in Into Nowhere, and go find it and take a look at the maps and the material I added and decide for themselves. And I believe that this will be a good basis now. We have enough information. We can start sorting things out and thinking about things, you know, that the information provided should at least get enough interest that hopefully other researchers will get involved and start following up on some of this stuff, because we desperately need it. You know, it's been so many years since Mr. Plight has started bringing out his books, you know.
Now, Thomas, do you have an internet site anywhere where you do any of this?
I do not at the moment. Basically, right now, I play around on Facebook and Twitter, and that's really all I have time for because I work full time. I do have a page set up of Tom Spriggs where you can go, and I include a couple of maps in the books from the Catskill Mountains and from Yosemite. I had to split the pages for the print version, so if you get the version, the online version of it in the Kindle, they may still be split. But if you go to Thomas, you look up Tom Spriggs on Facebook, I put the maps up whole. You can just download them and have them. They're yours.
Nice. Okay. All right. Any plans on what you're going to, if you're going to look into this in any particular direction next?
Not at this point. That was a long haul. It took a long time to find all this. Like I said, I put 10 and a half months into this. So right now, I'm just kind of taking a break and setting back. And I don't want to make another book and just do it just to be doing it, right?
Right.
I want, you know, if I want to add something to it, I want it to be a value, just like I feel that this book is a value. So for the moment, I'm going to kind of lay back and see what kind of interest and if we can get the ball rolling a little bit, you know, and then maybe if somebody comes up with something and it rings that bell in my head again, then I'll go ahead and continue and, you know, and hopefully we'll start getting some answers or at least getting some of our questions answered as far as that goes.
At least a few more pieces that take us in the right direction as to what's happening to all these people.
Oh, yes, sir. That would be great.
I mean, you look at the total number of people that go to the national parks, and it's a lot, and nothing ever happens to them. As you said, you've been out there, and nothing's ever happened to you.
Right.
But there's enough that are just mysteriously disappearing that something's going on.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I would like also to – yeah, I got it right here. There was a story that Mr. Plight has mentioned in one of his books, a little boy named Kurt Newton. He just disappeared in Maine from Chain of Ponds. They were camping out, right? And he was the one that had the little big wheel, and they found it on the edge of some quarry, right? And he was never found. There's more to that story, though, than just that. The police actually went and interviewed everybody and interviewed his mom. And his mom told this story to the police. His sister, they lived on a house where they had woods in their backyards. And his sister would go and play in those woods, but he never would. He always played up around the house. One day his mom said, well, why don't you go in the woods and play with your sister? She's just right there. I mean, you know, I'm assuming that it wouldn't be very far, probably a few yards.
Mm-hmm.
His reply was this, Mama, there's monsters in there. I that's all I can say about that. If that doesn't send chills down your spine, I don't know what will. But in one form or another, I think Mr. Newton might have been onto something.
And that is, I think, a perfect way to end this conversation for tonight.
Well, I appreciate being on. I thank you very much.
Yeah, and thank you for putting this together, Thomas. This is a good piece of work.
Thank you very much. I hope people get a chance to see it and enjoy it. And that's the main reason I put it down for, is just a spur thought. So thank you very much, sir.
All right, and that concludes my talk with Thomas Spriggs. If you have any comments or observations or comments or whatever, of course, shoot them our way. Send us an email, go into the forums, Facebook page, YouTube, whatever works for you. I try to answer as many as possible. And I want to thank everyone who already does that, who already comments to us, shoots us emails, so on and so forth. We're still collecting stories of personal experiences. I hope to be getting those up soon, regularly, maybe even doing an extra show every week or every other week on personal stories, encounters with the paranormal and such. And our outro music for tonight is by a man named Don O'Malley. And the song is called The Bus Going Home. If you like this, he doesn't have a website at the moment, but you can email him at gdonwow@gmail.com, and he will send you a copy of the song. I don't know if he has anything else out, but yeah, this seemed like a fitting outro song. And if you're a musician and you'd like us to use one of your songs at the end of the show sometime, get in touch, contact at whereattheroadgo.com. It does not have to be of any particular style. However, if it's appropriate to the type of stuff we talk about, all the better. And I'll see you next time.
Who am I to say what's going on? Driving the bus going home.